Title of our lesson is Dying Words. The subtitle of that is Words That Others Have Spoken at Death. It seems like I've gone to more funerals this year than I have in a few years. And it's kind of made me think a little bit about the nature of life. Jim Bedsworth passed from this life last week. He worked out, as he normally does in the morning, in the basement. He got up, finished his workout, came upstairs, would play a game of solitaire on the computer. That was his routine. And the last thing he said was Sherry, his wife. And by the time that she got to the computer, his teeth were clenched. She tried to give him an aspirin, but she feels like he was probably already gone that quick. He had passed away. His sister-in-law, Nita Bedsworth, passed away this past week. She was with family. Her speech suddenly became slurred. Quickly, she became unresponsive, and she never responded again until finally they took her off of life support, and she passed away. Many years ago, a couple by the name of the Holidays, Arch and Cletus Holiday, in the first place that I ever preached at, Arch was sitting in his recliner. He was waiting for his wife to get prepared to go to town. She was in the bathroom getting ready. She heard a gurgling sound. She came out and he had fallen out of his chair and had passed away of a massive heart attack at that point. We hear these stories and yet we think that all those kind of events take place in somebody else's life or with somebody else's loved one or not to me. And there's nothing about life on this planet that assures us of anything other than the fact that it's uncertain. Some have been able to live a period of time. I remember when I was in high school, my grandmother, my father's mother, she was diagnosed with cancer and kidney cancer. They took the tumor, but of course the cancer had spread. And so it was almost our weekly jaunt that we would drive from Tahlequah, Oklahoma, down to Fort Smith, Arkansas, where she was in the hospital. And we would spend the weekend there in the hospital. And I can remember, even after she got out of the hospital bed was moved into her house, and she stayed there in the living room. And every weekend we would go down there and we would wait for Grandma to pass. And I remember some of the words that she would speak, and she would oftentimes comfort the grandkids, comfort the kids, and say, I'm ready. I've lived a godly life. I'm ready. Others can tell stories of similar loved ones in similar circumstances whose dying words have been of great comfort unto the family. What I want to ask this morning as we contemplate this topic, I want to ask, what will your dying words be? I want to suggest to you that when faced with death, men see what is really valuable. Or they come face to face with the fact that maybe what they had thought was so valuable really wasn't that valuable. Oswald Chambers made this comment. He said, death has an amazing power of altering what a man desires because death profoundly affects his outlook. What will your dying words be? There are some who have had no chance to utter dying words. They've had no chance to impart some wisdom to their family members. They've had no opportunity to prepare them for their passing. As we mentioned with Jim Bedsworth, Anita Bedsworth, Arch Holiday, and others that you know that you can mention, there just wasn't the opportunity. Time was not afforded them. Their life, as James says, was a vapor. It appeared for a little while, and it vanishes away. And it vanished away rather quickly. The Bible tells us that some have faced death unprepared. They weren't ready for death. It's a terrible thing to understand that death is coming and you're not ready. Those that we have mentioned, I'm convinced we're ready for death. We're ready, even though it came unexpectedly upon them, Even though there was plans for the day, even though they had made preparations for the rest of that day, that rest of that day for them didn't go like they had anticipated. They passed. But some have faced death and they've been unprepared. It came upon them so quickly, they weren't ready. Their life wasn't prepared to be snuffed out that day. When you look at the story in Luke chapter 12, this man, when you look at what this man had done, this man, from one perspective, was prepared, wasn't he? Or at least he thought at this point in time, given his harvest, finally, he was prepared. Isn't that what the text acknowledges when you go to verse 20? When he has been given this admonition from the Lord, or this statement is made from the Lord that says, "You're a fool. This night your soul is required of you. And now who will own what you have what? Prepared." So he was a man that understood preparation. He was a man that understood that this harvest that he had just received, though he had many barns, he had preparation, but now he had the ultimate preparation. Here is a man that we say, here was a man that wasn't prepared, but he had prepared for life. He hadn't prepared for death. He had prepared for what? Many more years of life, in fact. He knew now that because of this harvest, because of what he had been given, now he could tear down these barns, he could build bigger barns, and now he was prepared for many years. He was prepared for life, but he wasn't prepared for death. And that's the thing that the Lord acknowledges in his statement. And he says in the beginning of his statement that he was what? He is a fool. Many of us would look at this man and say, "Wow, I'm not even as prepared in life as this man was." And yet, the Lord looked at him and said, "You're a fool because you haven't prepared for death." Most of us believe, if you're honest, we know, we say, "Oh, I know I could go anytime," but what do you really believe? You really believe you've got many years, don't you? You've got kids that are still young. You expect to see them graduate. You expect to have many more years. You have children that are at the teenage years. You expect to see them get married. You think you've got many more years. You have children who are married. You expect to be grandparents one day. You expect many more years. All of us believe we have many years. And therefore, we believe we should be prepared for them. And we look forward to them. But the question is, have we prepared for death? Death came upon this man and he wasn't prepared. Consider the dying words of some atheists. The first one you'll know, because this, when we think about dying words of atheists, this is the one that we always think about. Robert Ingersoll said, "Oh God, if there be a God, save my soul if I have a soul from hell if there be a hell." What did the atheist acknowledge? Even at death, it is great to talk about there is no God. It is fine to talk about that God is a ridiculous concept that has just been the invention of man, that are weak and that are unenlightened. But at the death's door that an atheist will stand before as they get ready to cross over into that realm that they know not about, even they acknowledge, as Robert Ingersoll did, the unpreparedness that even atheism gives to a man. Thomas Hobbes acknowledged that when he said, "I say again, if I had the whole world at my disposal, I would give it to live one day. I am about to take a leap into the dark." Atheism doesn't prepare one for death. Atheism doesn't prepare one for passing from this life. Thomas Paine, you'll remember, was the individual that wrote The Age of Reason and said that in his lifetime, it would replace the Bible. And yet, ironically, on those same printing presses that his book was printed, Bibles were printed some years later. He made this comment at his death: "Stay with me for God's sake. I cannot bear to be left alone. Oh Lord, help me. Oh God, what have I done to suffer so much? What will become of me hereafter?" Why would a man who was so convinced that he had reached the age of reason and that reason and logic could explain everything, on his deathbed, not pray to reason, not surround himself with colleagues that he had persuaded by his book, but instead appeal to the one that he said did not exist? Some have faced death and they've been unprepared. Some have faced death and they have died in faith. They have been prepared. Think about Joseph's dying words. My animation's fouled up. You get to see three of those. Think about Joseph's dying words that he gave to those that were still left of his family back in Genesis chapter 50. I want to suggest to you that Joseph's dying words reflected his faith in God and the promises that he knew would one day be fulfilled. Look in Genesis chapter 50, verses 24 through 26. Joseph said to his brothers, "I am about to die, but God will surely take care of you and bring you up from this land to the land which he promised on oath to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob." And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear, saying, "God will surely take care of you, and you will surely, and you shall carry my bones up from here." So Joseph died at the age of 110 years, and he was embalmed and placed in a coffin in Egypt. Those promises that Joseph referred to or mentioned in Genesis chapter 12, and we teach our young people that. Joseph said, "I know that we will leave this place. I know that this land that we're residing in, I know that one day our descendants will leave this land and will go and inherit the land that God has promised He will give to us." Joseph's dying words reflected his faith and the promise to God that had been made to his forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Turn to 1 Kings chapter 2, verses 2 through 4. David's dying words reflected an admonition to his son. What will you say to your children if you are diagnosed with cancer, with a heart condition, with something that gives you a little bit of time to be able to impart some wisdom? You're not going to be around any longer. You're not going to be there to be able to guide them through the rest of their life. And you know that maybe depending on when you choose to die or not choose to die, when you die, that you're not going to be able to be there and help them make the choices. You're not going to be able to help them guide them in the choices that you know they're going to have to make. If you know that you pass in this life before they marry, you know that that's going to be a major choice. If you're going to pass in this life before they have children, you want to be there to help them guide them, but you know you're not going to be there. Whatever it is, at whatever point in life that you pass, there will always be more that you want to help them and guide them through. And so what would be the final things that you would think you would say to your children? Listen to what David said to Solomon in 1 Kings chapter 2. "I'm going the way of all the earth. Be strong, therefore, and show yourself a man. Keep the charge of the Lord your God to walk in His ways, to keep His statutes, His commandments, His ordinances, and His testimonies, according to what is written in the law of Moses, that you may succeed in all that you do and wherever you turn, so that the Lord may carry out His promise which He spoke concerning me, saying, 'If your sons are careful of their way to walk before me in truth with all their heart, with all their soul, you shall not lack a man on the throne of Israel.'" David's dying words to his son were an admonition to obey. Think about Paul's dying words. As we look at this, I most agree that these are probably the last words that Paul spoke. Maybe a little bit more time was extended to him in life than possibly David or possibly Joseph. But these certainly reflect the man that understood his time was up and his opportunity to be of service in the Lord's kingdom was limited at best. And so he writes to the young man that he'd called his son of the faith, and he said, "I have fought the good fight. I have finished the course. I have kept the faith. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing." Paul's dying words reflected the hope by which he had lived his life. What a great testimony to be able to leave your children. "I have done what I should have done. I have lived how I should have lived. I have accomplished and finished the course that God has laid out for me. And because I have done that, I know what awaits me." The final words of a man of great confidence. Aren't those words so drastically different than the words that we read of the men who were atheists, who feared and were afraid? It's a step in the dark. Give me one more day. Push this day off one more time, one more opportunity, one more day. Don't let this happen today. And Paul says, "I've finished the course. I've run the race. I've done what God wanted me to do. I've lived how I should live." One of my grandfathers who passed away almost made that same statement. He said, "I've lived a righteous life. I've lived as God would have me to live. I'm prepared. I'm ready to go." That's all that Paul was saying. Paul's dying words reflected the hope by which he had lived and knew what awaited him. Stephen's dying words are a challenge probably to most of us. The very individuals that were killing him, the very individuals that were stoning him, Stephen's dying words were a prayer for him. When Stephen, being full of the Holy Spirit, gazed intently into heaven and saw the glory of God, Jesus standing at the right hand of God, and he said, "Behold, I see the heavens opened up and the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God." But they cried out with a loud voice and covered their ears and rushed at him with one impulse. And when they had driven him out of the city, they began stoning him. And the witnesses laid aside their robes at the feet of a young man named Saul. They went on stoning Stephen as he called on the Lord and said, "Lord Jesus, receive my spirit." Then falling on his knees, he cried out with a loud voice, "Lord, do not hold this sin against them." And having said this, he fell asleep. Not the dying words of someone that you would expect who was being murdered for something that he had not committed, for a crime that they had not proven him guilty of. These weren't words of vindication. These weren't words of "avenge me." These were words of "forgive them, for they do not understand what they are doing. Don't hold them. Don't hold this against them." What about the words of Jesus? The dying words of Jesus showed there are seven different sayings that our Lord uttered. The amazing thing about that is the majority of those sayings showed concern for others. As Jesus hung upon the cross, in John 19, verses 26 and 27, Jesus looks down and he sees his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby. And he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, "Behold your mother." And from that hour, the disciple took her into his own household. In Luke chapter 23 and verse 34, Jesus does the same thing. Stephen probably following the example of Jesus. Jesus says, "Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing," after they crucified him. And then after having a conversation with one of the individuals that was hanging up on one of the adjacent crosses, he said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you shall be with me in paradise." Here is a man searching for some sort of peace, searching for some sort of comfort in the hour of his death. And Jesus doesn't say, "I'm in enough pain over here on my own." Jesus says, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." Jesus' dying words were words of concern for others. I want you to suggest to you that it's interesting to note that there were some who spoke after death. That some, after their life was over, they actually had some words. Moses and Elijah is an example of individuals who spoke after death. As they came and they appeared on the Mount of Transfiguration with our Lord, and as he was transfigured, we see that they talked to Jesus about his death. Behold, two men were talking with him, and they were Moses and Elijah, who were appearing in glory, were speaking of his departure, which he was about to accomplish in Jerusalem. Some spoke even after death. Notice that we see the words of the rich man in the story of the rich man and Lazarus, words that he spoke after his death. And notice that as he speaks to Abraham, he talks about his brothers he's concerned with. He said to them, "I beg you, Father, that you send him to my father's house, for I have five brothers, in order that he may warn them, so that they will not also come to this place of torment." But Abraham said, "They have Moses and the prophets. Let them hear them." But he said, "No, Father Abraham, but if someone goes to them from the dead, they will repent." But he said to him, "If they do not listen to Moses and the prophets, they will not be persuaded, even if someone rises from the dead." Some spoke after death. But there are others who continue to speak, even after death, continue to speak from their example and from our memories of them in the life which they lived. Think about the statement that's made about Abel. It's amazing to think of all those that could have been selected in reference to great men of faith that still speak even though dead. It's interesting that the Hebrew writer chose to take that statement and apply it to Abel. When he says, "By faith Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks." Think about what is stated by the Hebrew writer after giving all of these individuals who have lived by faith. Think about what the admonition that he gives at the beginning of chapter 12. "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses," what's the implication? The implication is that it's not just Abel still speaking to us. The implication is that all of these men, all of these great men of faith still speak to us of the possibility of serving God against adversity, in spite of problems, in spite of the difficulties of that. All these men serve God in faith. They all speak to us of the fact that it can be done. "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us, as they did, lay aside every encumbrance and sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance, as they did, the race set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." A couple of questions we want to ask. Who still speaks in your life, though dead? There are probably some individuals in your life, if you've lived long enough, that have passed from this life. And there will be times in which you will know, "I'll need to do this." One of the individuals, the brother-in-law of Jim Bedsworth, my mom was telling me how that he sat round the clock at the hospital with Tom, who is Anita's husband. Sat with him, was there to support him and to hold him and to do whatever he could do. And my mom was telling me about that, said that that's not something we would have ever expected this particular person to do. He's not a Christian. He's a moral man, but he's not a child of God. But he made the comment, why he did that was because that's what Jim Bedsworth would have done. He would have done that for his own physical brother. And so Jim was dead by a week, but his example was still speaking. And this man said, "I'm going to do this for this man because that's what Jim would have done." That's the example that was left. What person is still speaking in your life even though they're dead? Well, let me ask you a second question. How will you speak to others when dead? How will your life of faith impact those, how will your life, maybe I'm assuming it's a life of faith, how will your life impact those when you're gone? How will you speak when others are dead? What will be your dying words? Did you live the words that you leave with them? You know, it doesn't matter what great words that you leave on your deathbed if those weren't the words that you lived by. They're going to ring hollow. They're going to have a hypocritical kind of sense to them. Did you live the words that you leave with your loved ones? You know, what made the words of David so powerful was that these were the words that David lived his life by. David, when he admonishes Solomon, prove yourself to be a man. This isn't just to go out and conquer the world. A man in the eyes of God was a man who lived by faith and acknowledged the commandments of God and lived by the commandments of God. Everything that David told Solomon to do, Solomon could look at the life of his father and know these are important. This is a critical decision. This is something that is paramount because that was the way David had lived. Your dying words will ring truer if they are words by which you'd lived your own life. What about words of faith like Joseph? What a great man to think about words of faith. Joseph's faith had been challenged on a variety of occasions. Why was he was the one that was born to Rachel? Why was he the firstborn of the son? Why was he the firstborn born to Rachel? Why did that lot fall to him, which meant that he became his father's favorite? Why was it that God gave him those dreams, which just added to the problem? Why was it that he was sold into slavery? Why was it that he was falsely accused? Why was it that he was forgotten for 2 years in prison? Why was it? All those incidences were challenges to Joseph's faith. Why am I continuing to believe in a God who's going to protect me when at every turn my life just gets worse? Why would I continue to believe in that God? And yet he did. And he continued to demonstrate that even in death when he said, and God's not done. And when he fulfills his promise, I don't want to be left in Egypt. I don't want my bones left here. I want them where God said, our people will live. And so he had his bones carried there. In the book of Joshua, that's exactly what they did. Words of hope like Paul. How do you explain the fact that a man would live as he lived, go to every city, know that his method of operation would probably get him into trouble, go to every synagogue of the Jews, know that the Jews would probably reject him, did reject him, cause more trouble for him than any other group of people caused him, and yet he would continue to do that? How is it that he would continue to serve God in the capacity that God had given him? Because he had hope. And the words of hope that he left were words of hope that he lived his life by. What about the words of concern that we see from Stephen and Jesus? Why was Stephen so plain in what he told the religious leaders in Acts chapter 7? Was he itching for a fight? Was he just trying to get into trouble? No, he told them exactly what they needed to hear. They needed to come to grips with the fact that their history was a history of rebellion. Quit looking at your history. Quit looking back at the way that you served God. Quit looking at your forefathers as if something better is here, as if something different is with you. You're doing exactly what they've done. You've always been stiff-necked and uncircumcised. And when you come to grips with that, you'll be able to understand what God has done in Jesus, you'll be able to accept that and you'll be saved. Even Stephen's sermon was a sermon given from a concern for them. They needed to hear the difficult things, even though they rejected it. If you lived your dying words, you'll leave prepared. If you have lived your dying words, they will continue to speak long after you're gone. None of us know when we're going to leave this earth. I don't know if it will be fast, if it will be in a car accident or a heart attack, or I don't know if it will be a long, protruded illness with cancer, and that I'll have plenty of opportunities to express words. I don't know. The important thing is that whatever words that we would like to say that we may not be given the opportunity to say, or that we do say, the important thing is the words that we live, or the words that we leave with our loved ones, have got to be the words that we live by. If we'll live by that, then those words will ring true, because they'll know this was important to Dad. Because the things that Dad told me, this is how Dad lived. I know this is important. He directed his life accordingly. What will be your dying words? I don't know. But I hope that they will be the words that you have selected to live by. And that even if you don't get the opportunity to specifically utter those words, your life will do it for you. Your life will say those words for you, even if you don't get the opportunity to state them. If you're here this morning, your life is not what it needs to be. It's not really meant, this lesson, to make one discouraged or depressed. It's just meant for us to be prepared in the right things. We prepared to come here by setting the alarm and getting up at the time that we needed. We prepared by ironing shirts and getting our clothing ready. We've made preparation for the rest of the day. We've made preparation for tomorrow. We've made a lot of preparation. There's nothing wrong with any of those things. The only thing that would make us a real fool is if we don't prepare to die. And if we're not prepared to die, all the other preparations are totally and absolutely irrelevant. But if we prepare to die and we keep our focus on the right things and we don't get caught up in the things of this life and the things of this world, and we remember we are just pilgrims wandering through this place to get to where we belong, if we can keep our focus there, then we'll be prepared for that. We will have put our treasure in heaven, not on this earth. If you're here, your life is not what it needs to be, and we can help you make it right. Won't you let us know what we can do? If you'll come forward, together we stand and sing our song.